Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
This week on Meet and Three, it's our 100th episode. We're breaking the mold to kick off our mini-series on global trade.
Vegetables, fruits, grains, and cooking technique pass from one region to another. And that's interesting that that region transform that ingredient into their own specialties.
There was a time where black pepper was a luxury. And we know that because people were willing to invest huge amounts of money to go to the Spice Islands in order to get pepper. You know, stuff we take for granted now. You know, you go into a restaurant and it's free.
Tune in to Meat & Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the show, Beatrice Ajero, right? That's your last name?
Yes,
it is. You say that right? Okay. Yes. I'm thrilled to have you on. We are recording. We don't know when this will go live, but we are pre-recording. It's still 2020, so wrapping up what has been an incredibly tenuous year for a lot of people, and especially for people in the food industry. And so, one, I'm grateful to have your time, one, during the holidays, and then also for a time that's, I'm sure, has been incredibly challenging, and we'll go into that. But wanted to start off with having you tell us a little bit about your personal story. So how did you're Nigerian American. How did your family end up here in the U.S.? And then, sort of your earliest memories of food, or your interest in food, how that came to be.
Sure. Well, thank you for having me. I'm really excited to get a chance to share on your platform. I've had a chance to listen to a lot of my colleagues in this space around the state and abroad. So I'm super excited to share. So I've known that I've wanted to be associated with food in some way for many years, since I was much younger, actually, around 10, 11, and 12. My parents came to the U.S. as college students in the 80s, and I think I've learned a lot about how they have, tried to find the comparable ingredients for traditional cooking. Mm-hmm. Growing up, okra and spinach were things that we knew we could always find in every grocery store. And tomatoes and red pepper always lent itself to red stew. So those are two items that I think were mainstays in my sort of childhood for myself and my siblings.
What city were you in?
Sure. This is New York City. So I was born in New York City, and I grew up on Roosevelt Island. And we are in proximity to Queens, which is, the most diverse corner in the world. And so I think the grocery stores there and in our neighborhood, Roosevelt Island is an experimental community. So we have one grocery store, one cleaners. And but still within that, we're able to find okra and spinach growing up and find tomatoes. So I think that has had an influence on me. Wherever I've been as a young person in school, I've always known that I could at least find those items and make some iteration of an okra and spinach or a stew, and then use whatever starch, if it's oatmeal, if it's pounded yam, or if it's gari, to be the companion for that. So, but that, I think, is one of the things that's really shaped the way I think about food and food traditions. And my interest in food started off around baking, actually. I did a lot of baking when I was younger, and took a lot of pastry making classes. But I think that my family wanted me to have a lot of skills across a lot of different subject matters before entering into the culinary world. And so that's what they pushed me to do. And so I went to a school called Bard College in the Hudson Valley for my undergraduate degree in human rights. And I went to the University of Buffalo's law school to study finance and transactions. And I saw, I think I saw the importance in an MBA or a sustainability-minded MBA to help contextualize a lot of the things that I saw in the legal realm. And so I went to back to Bard, which had a young program that was based in New York City for my MBA in sustainability. And around the same time, I completed a double master's in special and general education.
Oh, so, my goodness. Wow. You definitely, I'm sure your Nigerian parents must be very proud.
So you
ticked all those boxes so that there are no questions around. That's great. So one of the questions I was pondering as I was thinking about your story is a lot of it seems to be born of your experiences in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Have you gone back home? Have you traveled, mm-hmm. On the continent? So I just wanted to get a little bit more context in terms of, like, practically, like, outside mm-hmm. of your education and your family, if you've had some time, if you spent mm-hmm. some time on the continent, and how that has informed even your ideas around sustainability and getting that MBA, for example.
Sure, yeah. So as an undergrad, I studied with human rights and Africana studies. So I was really open to, as an undergrad, it's more about more literature and anthropology, but I had a chance to study abroad in Johannesburg. So I spent 3 or 4 months actively in Joburg as a student there, and always keen to learn about food traditions in KwaZulu-Natal, or the many other cultural groups that are present there. I spent a lot of time with Zimbabweans there, so Shona speaking, Ndebele yeah. speaking, friends there. I got to learn about pap, which is the corn yeah. version, right, of fufu.
I remember. I'm sure if you've listened to the podcast quite a bit, I lived in Joburg for 2 years.
Yes,
so. Yes. So, when I hear pap, that takes me back to to Braai's and having pap
oh, yes.
and chakalaka and all that good stuff.
Oh, yeah. So it was a great... I had been to Nigeria in my first year of school to see my family and to visit my relatives, and there just keeping an eye on the market. In the short period of time I was there, I learned so much about the access to greens or how protein enters food, and how my relatives were living in Port Harcourt, which is a port city in Nigeria. So mm-hmm. That also influenced how they cooked. So it was a great experience for me, but I think after South Africa, I was doing a research project that took me to Nigeria and Ogoja, which is close to the Cameroonian border in Cross River State. And it was there that I saw a lot of sort of veteran farmers, a lot of yam, just really lush vegetation that's in Ogoja. Again, learning about cuisine in the Cross River State area, which Eddie Kaiko is one of the items on our menu, which is considered a very Calabar Cross Rivers a soup. And that was one of the things that I got to sort of see firsthand from family friends. And after that trip to Nigeria, I had a chance to see Senegal, Mauritania, and Morocco.
Oh, wow.
I studied Arabic in Mauritania, so that was really interesting because I was living with a Pula family, so I got to see a lot of the Pula traditions around mm. communal eating, around mm. mishui, around the way a lot of, I think, more citrus items come into meals. The use of mortar and pestle for like a lot of aromatic things was really impressive to me. And then at the same time, the Hassaniya traditions, big communal eating. So that was great. And of course, I've had a lot of family friends on Rosewood Island from Senegal who really basically sent me to, you know, stay with their families as I wanted to see their home countries. But then, you know, the Yassa, the Chebujen, and all the Mafé, all those great soups, too, I got to see firsthand when I was between Senegal and the Gambia. But specifically, I think when I started to really pay attention to how sourcing and supply chain and sustainability intersect was when I was in the Gambia. And the Gambia is a really small, delightful country, coastal, from end to end. And I ran bakeries and restaurants there between my second and third year of law school. And there was a question around amongst my team about millet, dugum, versus the wheat that was imported from Turkey. And so there was a preference for a whole wheat, to make whole wheat, you know, bakery products. And we had a sizable section of our market that was interested in other kinds of grains because of the glycemic index.
Right.
But it wasn't sizable enough, I think, for us to think that millet could be what we used for all of the bread products. And so I thought a lot about how millet could come from the other side of the water and be a more sustainable grain that we could use and bake with. I noticed that when I spent time with the Tapalapa factories, which are mostly run by Pular families, that's basically the brick oven bread, brick oven baguettes that are made in Guinea and Gambia. All of the many steps in their supply chain to even source, the firewood from Senegal to bring it in and then to source the grain and at volume, because they, you know, once they light that oven, it has to really, you know, churn out a lot of bread. And so when I came back to the U.S. and really thought about the sustainability MBA, I thought a lot about my experiences in the Gambia and how I could learn about different ways of thinking about sourcing and supply chain and access that I think most closely tied to what I saw in the Gambia and all that I learned from bakers and friends and my team there. So that trip, I think, was really impactful still sort of shapes what I do now.
Wow, that's really cool. And that's a wonderful, my God, so like a really wonderful experience. And you're sort of crisscrossing all over the continent. I lived in the Gambia too. And so it's funny, in Banjul, I lived for a year. And I remember, how small it was. And even just finding things to do in Gambia. But then also, I don't know if that was the experience for you, but I also found a lot of at least the hospitality scene was, or I should say mainstream hospitality scene, however you want to describe that, was sort of focused or catered towards the big European. And again, that was their sort of bread and butter in terms of tourism from Europe. And so a lot of the experiences around food and all of that was catered towards that audience, at least in my experience. But that's awesome. You had a great experience there.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that I think Gambia, much like Senegal, Mauritania, very family-oriented around food. So at 2 o'clock is when Chebujen starts rolling out, right? So a lot of my guys, you know, 2 o'clock, everything stops and rice starts coming in from all their family and relatives or their, you know, our neighbors. And so I remarked to one of a customer recently, a lot of neighbors in the story area like to bring their own containers sometimes for their sustainability position for taking food, and I welcome that as a way to connect with what we see a lot at home. And I remember in the Gambia, and I think elsewhere in Africa, every time you see someone carrying some kind of kwangolo canteen wrapped in a fabric, that's you know, so endearing, really a sign that your family is thinking about you. So certainly as someone coming in looking for, you know, I guess food on the move, if you compare it to Ghana or Nigeria, where Mama Put is everywhere. Certainly in the Gambia, it wasn't as accessible, I think, because of this, you know, heavy emphasis on family. But yeah, in Banjul too, there were some, there's some nice Lebanese restaurants that I found that I was able to, you know that they'd have the shawarmas and the fattoush and that sort of thing. But I hear you. I hear you.
Okay, so now let's transition to then. So you had all those great experiences, then you came back, and what was the sort of impetus, I guess, for starting your restaurant, Neji, right?
I think we've always wanted to bring West African food to our neighbors, my family and I. Mm-hmm. I've always had to venture into Harlem, which was sort of just like a mark for our week every Sunday to go and see and connect with community there, yeah. Like Petit Senegal on 116th mm-hmm. Street,
yeah.
Places like Accra Restaurant would cater most of our naming ceremonies or our some of our private events as we started out early on. So we developed, you know, friends that go back decades that are based in Harlem. And so it was always a treat for us. And we've always thought about ways of bringing more of those food traditions closer to home. And home mm-hmm. for us was Roosevelt Island. And so when we, we were initially an art gallery on Roosevelt Island and evolved into, an annual vendor at the Saturday Market. Where we felt like we had an opportunity to get close to community. But we did so with more like nostalgia items like the Nido and the Peak and the Milos of the pantry, the corned beef and the Titan sardines. So we thought that that would be a good way, at least for families who cooked, or and a lot of our neighbors were posted here either by their governments or for their diplomatic corps. And so we felt like these were items that also connected many other, cultures and people of other countries. So we began very early on with those non-perishable specialty items. But when we moved into our first brick and mortar in Astoria as a gift shop, a lot of customers who came in asked us where the quote-unquote real food was. So we were very surprised. They said, you know, we have sardines, we have Nida, we have malt, you know. And so we were really pleasantly surprised. We brought in a lot of sort of textile and art and home decor on the Africa side, and then we saw that there were so many items that cut across many different cultures. So we did oil, spices, and grains because we felt like it was things that many people could connect with. But there was this big push around hot food as a way to really access and understand West Africa and its traditions. And so with the support from our gift shop and the area, we sought out to bring the hot food offerings that we now have at Neji to Astoria. And we thought that it would be a good home because Astoria is considered the most diverse corner of the world, and we knew that food wasn't necessarily new, or food traditions weren't necessarily new to Astoria, but we'd have a chance to contribute and to join the existing efforts to preserve heritage, which which is one of the pieces that the name Neji speaks to, by situating ourselves in Astoria.
Well, tell us what does Neji mean when you translate it? What language is it? What Nigerian language is it?
Sure. So Nigeria has 550 languages and 800 language groups.
Yeah.
Right? And when we get into dialects, we may be into the thousands. So it's one of the things I think I'm most proud about that Nigeria offers. And my family speaks Igbo, which is just one of the many 800 mm-hmm. languages of the Southeast region. And in Igbo, as a language, there are many dialects, but if you transliterate mm-hmm. Igbo, which it can't really be translated, but if you transliterate it, name means mother, and Jie means to hold on to. So you know, some I translated as or transliterated as may I never be disconnected from my maternal lineage. May I never forget where I come from. So many of our neighbors near our gift shop or Greek businesses and Italian businesses that Sicilian bakeries that really were a big part for us in learning about the heritage preservation. I think that defines the story to a great degree. We really moved to try to join that effort, and so when we're in a story, we think about all of the time and energy that's been placed in preserving heritage for decades, which I think is one of the reasons that so many people of all different backgrounds have sought to call it home.
Wow, yeah. That's so powerful, and I'm sure your mom must be so proud of you. So let's talk about what's on the menu, the fun stuff. What's on the menu? What do you have at Niche? And then maybe just quickly, just tell us what's on the menu.
Sure. So we have, we've started off with a lot of, with four core vegan offerings, that most of which we stayed with. One is yassa. The other is red stew, egusi soup, and okra. More currently, we have we try to always have okra and spinach, egusi, and yassa as vegan offerings. And we have red stew with beef, and it's bacalao, cow foot, cow skin, and that soup, and that stew. And we have a spicy goat stew that is sort of in the Igbo tradition of ngwongwo, which is like, I call it more of a party item that can be made with like goat head or escargot or a cow skin. But we've done it with the goats too. And so it also allows us to put a lot more heat in one of the dishes, as everything, the pepper is more sort of for balance. Mm-hmm. But here we really try to make it the hottest thing on the menu. So so friends can find that.
Yeah.
And then... Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then we pair with two grains, which is Gary and Fonio. It is also allowed us to be more regional than country specific, which is what we hold ourselves out to be.
Yeah, so that's what I was going to ask you next, in terms of, like, just because I heard yassa, I was like, I don't think that yassa is necessarily Nigerian. And so are you trying to be more West African versus Nigerian?
Well, short answer would be yes. I think that there's a dish in northern Nigeria that is like yassa, because that's also where a lot of onions grow. In addition to being regional, we've also tried to, we have eforiro, we have edikaika, which are Yoruba dishes or Calabar dishes. But we have also tried, and okra spinach is soup kanja, Senegal and Gambia. Or gumbo, right, in New Orleans. So we've tried to be both regional, both diasporic, and then also try to showcase some of the great dishes of different parts of Nigeria and that region. So we're still looking to add some more favorites. So
yeah, one of the things I noticed as I was looking up or reading what you offered was that you also do, and I think this is a function of like where you're located, I guess, that you also offer Greek and Italian pastries. Wanted to get the story, what the story is behind. I'm guessing it's a function of your location, but...
Yeah, well, we grew on Rosewood Island, in great part due to the support of a Sicilian bakery called Rose and Joe's, which has been around since the 1970s. And so I think we became really known for the ciabattas and the panellas and the baguette, which, like, you know, the tapalapa experience that I had in the Gambia really pushed me to see the importance of bread as also very universal. So we can really bring the world home, as we like to say in Ibarri. But that's one of the things that we knew, you know, you could use with any dish, right? You could dip, you could, you know, use with soups and stews. And so it's allowed us to really, I think, connect to our neighbors, many of which are from, you know, as far as the Pacific Islands or Eastern Europe. And so when we pushed into bread, oil was one of those other categories that we felt like right? For us, palm oil is gold. You know, I tell everyone it's liquid gold. But I know that olive oil is the palm oil of the Mediterranean.
Right.
And so we started to source olive oil from Crete and from Morocco and from different countries. Again, things that so many people can connect with, either just for medicinal reasons or for cooking. And so when we were situated at Neji, we wanted a chance to continue the celebration of the shared food traditions of between the Mediterranean and West Africa and beyond. And so with pastries, we're able to do that. So kunefa is shredded phyllo dough in Egypt and kataifi in Greece. For Ethiopian cuisine, baklava is one of the choice desserts. And so it's also allowed us to sort of give a nod to Eastern Africa in that way and Northern Africa in that way as we try to acknowledge all the different regions of African food traditions and the Mediterranean. But yeah, we strongly believe that acknowledging the all of the communities that have really anchored Astoria as we bring you know, our own food tradition is it just, I think it's just a sign of being a good neighbor for us.
Right.
And we're grateful for the partnerships, the strong partnerships that we've developed with a lot of our Greek distributors and our Sicilian bakeries, our partners. So that's why you see the baklava and the biscotti there.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Mm-hmm. And I never would have thought about that connection between the Mediterranean and Northern Africa, Eastern Africa, even. Well, that's mm-hmm. That's really cool. Yeah. Okay, so I think this is a good time to take a quick break. Mm-hmm. And then when we come back from the break, we'll talk about sort of your process for opening the restaurant. I don't think we even touched on it yet, but you opened this restaurant in 2020 when a lot of restaurants are closing down.
Sure.
So I think it would be interesting to hear what that's been like, your lessons learned, and how things have been going. So we'll take a quick break and then we'll jump back right in.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2 Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
So back from the break, fascinating background. Like, I think when I first read your story, I didn't know all about, you know, your travels all over the continent and the connection to what you did with your MBA in sustainability. And that's all really cool. And I like the fact that you have that at the back of your mind, you know, as you're one opening and building this restaurant. And I think even going forward, in a post-COVID world, I can see how the work you're doing is going to be really important as you start to probably, hopefully, connect with other African food businesses and how we think about the way we bring our traditions into Western, you know, the Western communities that we live in. And the lessons that we can also, because I think in terms of my conversations with people, it's sometimes challenging because I hear people trying to, you know, fit into what they think people want. But I think that there's a lot that we can also bring to the table, mm-hmm. just in terms of what you learned, you know, when you were in Gambia, for example, around sourcing and, you know, even trends that today are becoming, you know, cool or trendy or whatever in terms of sustainability. Even the examples you gave of canteens being tied in fabrics and whatnot. Like, we've always had some of these traditions. And so thinking about how we bring those back to what is essentially home to us, but, you know, it's becoming more mainstream here in the West. So it's, I'm pretty cool. I'm glad I learned new stuff about you. But now, now let's talk about your resilience. I mean, who decides to open a restaurant mid? So when did you open? When did you open? I'm sure you know you were leading up to it before all of this happened. But when in 2020 did you open? For context.
Yeah, well, we opened officially on June 9th.
Wow! So the pandemic was already.
It was pretty active, I'd say. But I guess we had decided by March 1, actually, was when we, that was when really the beginning of our lease term. And when we got to the neighborhood, we had come around a couple of times, but when I saw my neighbors boarded up, I thought that maybe they were renovating. So I thought it was just a great, great, you know, time. I thought they were renovating. So it was like, you know, but I didn't realize that they were closed indefinitely. Thankfully, many of them are reopened, you know, which has made where we are, you know, just a really delight to, you know, for, I think, families to walk down. But it also meant that the neighborhood was very quiet. So we didn't get the same pulse of who our neighbors really were and who the families were and who we'd meet until we reopened. And then when the governor had given us a green light, we really felt like at the phase two mark, we really felt like we had a chance to share the hot food and the groceries and the pastries. So, you know, I think that the universe designed it this way, and we are grateful for the support that we've had from the neighbors. And, you know, our partners from near our gift shop have really helped to anchor us. And Roosevelt Island has been a big, big source of support for us on Saturdays. And so I think as we've come to learn and to become, you know, to sort of form, you know, kinship ties with our community there, we are sort of all, we really are all in this together, you know. And so from our neighbors who are there to the, you know, the friends who come in and see us, that's how we feel. And as we all work in our, you know, different little corners, to put one foot in front of the other, that's, you know, we're doing just the very same. So and hopeful.
Yeah. So in terms of just if I want to take a step back in terms of even trying to attract customers, right? Because when I think about, you know, long-standing establishments in New York that have had to close down, I'm wondering now for someone that's opening and fairly new to that community, how do you get the word out about, you know, what you're doing so that people can support you? And then just how have you kept going? You know, is it, has the experience been obviously probably not what you expected, but what are the things that you've done differently than you thought? You know, how did you pivot, I guess, is the question, in terms of what you were expecting to do versus what you're doing now?
Sure. So we, I think it was helpful that we had an established footprint at our gift shop. So it was a different brand, but about a mile away. So we were at least known to some degree for the art and the home decor there. And then, you know, Roosevelt Island is also sort of a mile in the other direction, which allowed for some synergy. But I can tell you that where we are on 34th Avenue at Neji, really was the just the heart of the those who have 34th Avenue as their thoroughfare to come in from day one and say, welcome to the neighborhood. We're happy you're here. You know, we're so excited for you. We're rooting for you. You know, wow, way to go to open in such a tough time. You know, so much good energy just sort of overwhelmed us in the first few days and first few weeks that was really just really heartwarming. And I think that, you know, one of the things that we've done is really just, you know, continue to listen. And because we're not in a time where maybe we would have seen more of the neighbors, so we have, you know, visitors coming in, customers coming in. We also have a lot of our customers reaching out through the online delivery platforms. So really just trying to keep a pulse as to what people put in the notes, what customers put in the notes. There was a season where a few customers were asking for pounded yam in the notes, which we didn't necessarily carry. And so I was so puzzled because I said, oh my goodness, they're asking for pounded yam. And, and so now we make pounded yam to order, So that has helped, I think, to really just keep an open ear and to listen and have feedback. And I think we've tried to maintain a core vegan items and also a number of proteins. And also in our spice blend, we use protein so that customers who are looking for vegan choices can still have access to balance, in our menu. And I think we really had to just listen. I say we, I'm supported by my family and these ventures. And so we just had to listen and iterate and think. But we're grateful also to have a number of write-ups early on to tell the story of what we hope to bring. And I think that's a lot of people who maybe would not have chosen our block as a thoroughfare to then think about us and come on over. And we're really, really grateful for the many different outlets that have run, pieces of different sizes on us. And, we're really grateful for that.
Yeah, so just a quick word on that, actually, because for a lot of smaller African, because when I come to New York, I lived in New York before, and so I have New York as a special place in my heart. But when I come back to New York, I typically, like you, would go to Harlem to get, my comfort African, food from all over the continent. And when I think about some of those businesses and the access that they have to, even media to get the word out there, because I think a lot of them are mostly patronized by the community, right? Just by word of mouth and just knowing that in Harlem you're going to get the best of that food. So outside of the bigger ones like Taranga and Chef Pierre, who, have their sort of big press stuff, how did you tap into local press? Just for those that may be listening that may be trying to do the same. What was practically, did you reach out to people? How did that happen for you?
Yeah, well, we did have support to think about the different channels that are in Queens. Working with a very, very seasoned and dedicated PR agent has helped us find different channels to share our story. So I think for a small venture like ours, we're very, very grateful to have that specialized knowledge in our corner, who's really sort of, carved out to focus on that when you're doing so many other things and, believe strongly in what we do. And I think, my mom always told me that the job of an entrepreneur is to be continually excited about your venture. And so when you can have the support and other wings to focus on things like telling your story or, sharing through Instagram, it helps. We are built on conversation. So for us, it was a bit of a pivot, particularly for hot food. We really like to talk and we really like to take time. And that's what I think market is about at home. And so we really try to bring that energy to wherever we are. I think in the hot food space, when families or individuals in faraway places get to hear about you through different channels, it really means a lot to them. And so we've seen families coming from Staten Island or from the Rockaways or from New Jersey and so or upstate New York, just very, very touched by, the people who have sought us out to come and to root us on, and it has meant a lot. So I think that's one of the ways to tap into to press. And, to Harlem, Harlem is where I went to school for 10 years and where I spent a lot of time, with my family, connecting with community. And sometimes people come to us and ask for very specialized items like chebujin or wachi and shito, right? Some of my favorite things. And so I have to send them to my friends, in Harlem. And many of them are aware of them. But And what we've also tried to do before now for some of our private events is to, harness the power of the network by bringing in, catered items from these different businesses in Harlem to Roosevelt Island. And so it's allowed, for naming ceremonies and things like that. So it's always very fun for us to do that and partner with, food businesses in Harlem. And some people come in and they say, I want a bespoke piece. So I'll send them to a tailor in the 116th Street Market that I've known for 20 years. So, my hope is that Harlem still maintains its, reputation as being, home, because it's been home for us. But we just we're looking to add, I guess, one point along the way.
Yeah, for sure. I think that it would be great to have a few more like little hubs of African food throughout the, I don't know if I would even say one in every borough. Maybe it might be nice. All right. So as we're getting close to wrapping up here, what for you is the thing you want people to take from experiencing? So I guess the greatest value you want people to take from experiencing your food and everything else that you have to offer.
Well, yeah, we really like the feedback that comes from customers who come in and tell us that they feel good after they've eaten our food. So we want you to feel good. We really want you to feel like you've added something, nutritionally sound to your, your meal options for the day. We also want you to feel as though you have learned something about a new food tradition that possibly can connect with yours. Because we love to share recipes at the restaurant or at the market. We do that a lot, and so to hear how different types of okra and different sizes of okra or goulash or things like that very excites us a lot. So. And then just really the spirit of the kindred, for in Igbo land, there's a lot of our maternal kindred, our umune, is where I spent a lot of time in New Jersey, is where my maternal kindred is. And so that's where all kinds of soup, all kinds of, bitter leaf, okazi, you name it, flows in New Jersey. And so as a kid, I was going to my auntie's house or my mom's aunt's house. In my kindred is where I could eat without shame anything at any time all day. Yeah. Right. And so that's really the spirit that we look to bring, to the neighborhood. We're hopeful that both in our menu choices and, the other items, we started to add a lot of apothecary and personal wellness items that are from our gift shop. The state has asked us to make sure that there are some essentials that, people can access when they come into the shop. And so you've tried to really push some natural versions of those, like black soap and shea butter is actually how we began several years ago. Those were the two products that we launched with. So having a chance to now share that through Neji, it's been really special. So if I distill it, I would say the feeling of kindred and something, nutritionally sound. And also I tell a lot of visitors that I want you to get ready for your next Nigerian party. So I hope that, or Senegalese party. Some people ask to mix like yassa with red stew. I say, okay, but it may not be like that at the party, but my goal really is for anyone also who's seeking either career or travel or to extend themselves into our communities, that they feel like they have an entry point through food, which I think is probably 70-80% of that world. So I think that, for me, when I was going to Joburg, the first thing I did was to find a restaurant in the city where I could learn about the food tradition before traveling. So I'm hopeful perhaps that the visitors who come in to see us can also feel like that helps equip them for, a trip to the continent or, a function in some West African community. Something nutritionally sound, I think especially today when a lot of customers are working from home, they always say, okay, you know, I want to take a break and I want to, you know, make sure that I, you know, add something good to my day. And then an entry point into the region or diaspora cooking, so that they feel like they can either leverage, you know, themselves professionally or personally, you know, in a West African function or country. And the feeling of kinship or that kindred spirit, I really hope that, you know, is something that they feel when they've left any of our establishments, but particularly at an age where I think through hot food we're able to share a lot. So those are the major ones.
Oh yeah, no, that's really great. Before we go into our rapid fire questions, can you let people know where they can find you in Astoria, your opening hours, all of that? So where, even if they want to get delivery, where they can find that, and sure, then on social media, website, all of that good stuff.
Yeah, so Neji is located at 3220 34th Avenue in Astoria. We're open from 11:30 to 10, Monday through Thursday. We close at 9 on Fridays. So we're open very early at the Saturday market from 9 to 2 or 8 to 2. And we open for dinner at Neji again from 5 to 9. Our gift shop, Ibarri, is at 26-16 23rd Avenue. And we're open Mondays, Fridays, and Saturdays, and by appointment during the week. We have an Instagram at Neji_Astoria or at ibarri.nyc. Our phone number is on Google. So if you have any questions, we'd love to talk. So please feel free to reach out and stay connected.
Sure, and I will include this in the show notes so people can just click on those links to be able to find your line. And hopefully, I'm keeping my fingers crossed that we can get back to traveling and I can be back in New York soon to try it out. I miss New York. Okay, so a rapid fire question, super simple, easy, nothing embarrassing here. First question is sweet or salty?
Sweet.
You paused on that.
I'm thinking about what my mother would want me to say. I don't know if she would want sweet. Okay. Yeah.
All right. Dine in or take out? I don't know. With COVID, this is now a tough question to answer, but.
I'll say take, you know, right now it's all takeout for most of, you know, for what we can. If you have a chance to dine in, but I'd say takeout, you know, sit on the floor at home, you know, invite a friend over.
Eat with your hands.
That's right. That's
that good
right.
Stuff. Okay, so if you had to choose, would you want more money or more free time?
More free time. Yeah, more free time, I guess.
Okay. questioning the money piece. All right. And then for this sentence to complete, this year I'm going to try and eat more what?
Ukazi soup.
Oh, is that something you offer at Neji or no?
Not yet, but I'd love to. It's very, very powerful for the body and very, very traditional, so... so yeah, that's the goal.
Okay, cool.
Yes.
And then the last question, your favorite African restaurant anywhere in the world that is not yours?
Oh, too many to choose from. I have to choose one, huh?
Yeah.
Favorite. Oh, that's not a fair one. I don't know if I can choose. You have to be a three-way tie between Accra, Teranga, and Ajakaji, all in Harlem.
I don't know the last one.
Ajakaji, 116th Street, best chebujin, one of the best chebujins that my brother loves. Yeah.
I need to check that out. I don't think I've been.
So if I could plug Wachi Shito at Accra.
Yeah.
Yes, and then anything at Teranga. Even just the vibe, yes.
Yeah, the vibe at Teranga, for sure.
Yes.
It's pretty good. Cool. Well, this was great. Thank you for chatting with me, Bee Gees. I It was a pleasure chatting with you and learning more about your story. I learned more than I thought I had already read about, which is great. And I hope that people get to go to Neji, try it out. It sounds fabulous to me. This is, again, one of those reasons why I miss living in New York, or even visiting New York, is all of the amazing African foods that I can find and, like, find a way to find home. And it sounds like that's what you're trying to create here at Neji. So good luck. I hope 2021 is much better for you than, I guess, for all of us, really, than this year has been. I'm sure, you know, it's brought its lessons in resilience and even learning about community, it sounds like, with you. And I hope that some of those lessons stay with us as we navigate this new year. So thanks.
For sure. Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Item 13, an African food podcast. If you like the show, please subscribe, rate, and review us on your favorite podcast app. To keep up to date, follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Item 13 Podcast. Item 13 is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.